Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the all-new Opel Crossland. Beauty isn't scared of life.
Well, you saw it again on the news last night. You just heard Vincent in the news bulletin there. Another night of violence in Northern Ireland. I'm going to be talking in a few minutes' time to Jonathan Powell, former Chief of Staff for Tony Blair and one of the chief negotiators of the Good Friday Agreement, and also to Alex Kane, political columnist and commentator. But I want to begin with something a little bit more personal. On the line now is Nicola McKee Corner, whose sister Lyra McKee was shot dead while observing rioting in the Creggan area of Derry on April 18th, 2019. Good morning, Nicola.
Good morning, Philip. How are you?
I'm fine. How has it been for you, though, watching the last 9 nights of news now?
It has been extremely difficult, to be perfectly honest with you. It's been difficult for many reasons, you know, especially because Belfast has been really a hot spot for a lot of this civil unrest and violence that people have seen across the world. And that's where I live. And it's been difficult as well because we're coming up very much closer and closer to Lyra's second anniversary. And as people will be aware, Lyra was killed during a riot.
That's just over a week away now, is it, that second anniversary?
It's on Sunday.
You live quite close to where an awful lot of this activity has been taking place.
Oh, yes, I do. So it's very, very concerning. And I've got friends and family members that live on both sides of these peace walls that people have been trying to burn down and break through. So it's very, very concerning.
And what do you despair at the most, Nicola? Is it the young people who feel that this is a solution to their grievances, or the adults who appear to be standing by and cheering them on?
The young people probably are not fully aware of why they're doing what they're doing. You know, a lot of them are being caught up in the mob mentality and joining in without fully being aware of the reasons why they're doing it. For some of them, it's just a bit of fun to get involved in this and a bit of excitement. And the adults have much more responsibility. I mean, they have influence that they can use over the young people, and they're not using it, rather than saying, stop doing this in our area, stop doing this, let's have a chat about this, let's see what the problem is. They're actually encouraging it, and I think that that's really frightening and disheartening.
I see in your conversations with journalists like Donna Deeney, Rodney Edwards, that you're thinking about telling your own children to get up and get out of Northern Ireland society as soon as they can.
This is true. I have already said to my children, who are all now adults, that they need to look to find a way to get out of our country, because I feel, and this seems to show, that we're always going to be held prisoners to a past. You know, a past that we weren't involved in, and are being held to ransom for at every turn when things don't go the way of people in certain sections of the community. It always seems to go back to really barbaric kind of behaviour, and that's just not the way I want my children to have to live, and it's not the way that I want my grandchild to be brought up. And, you know, we've protected them for all of these years. And we always had hope that Northern Ireland would become a much more civil place. And unfortunately, it seems that we're always going to be held prisoner to the past.
In your opinion, what does proper political leadership look like now? What should be happening? What should we be hearing from the party leaders?
Well, the party leaders should be coming out and onto the streets to actually engage with the people who are claiming to be so disaffected that they're turning to violence. They should be having conversations with them to find out what the issues are and what can be done to alleviate those issues, not ignoring them like some politicians have done, and then others have been stoking the fires. They've been holding the matches themselves, and that is reprehensible in my view. They need to take good and proper leadership now, and they need to do it quickly before someone is seriously injured, or my greatest fear, someone is killed.
On a personal level, Nicola, before all of this blew up, in the course of the last 2 years since Lyra was taken from you, had things gotten easier? Had they improved?
For me personally?
Yeah.
No. No. My mummy became very sick after Lyra was killed and died of a broken heart in March last year. I've been obviously trying to support a lot of people within my family since Lyra was murdered, including my mother, and then again since my mother passed away. And it's very difficult to also know that the person who killed Lyra is walking free and living their life, and we are having to suffer every single day because of what they did through absolutely no fault of our own, and it's very, very, very difficult to deal with.
And presumably watching what we're all watching now on the news is particularly traumatising for you, because you're thinking to yourself, it's only a matter of time before what happens to Lyra happens to somebody else.
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. It's very, very frightening, the thought that, you know, I mean, when people were standing in the Craigan on the 18th of April 2019, no one could have anticipated a gunman coming out and firing up the street towards a group of onlookers. No one could have anticipated that. And in the same way, no one knows that in this violence that is continuing at the moment, that somewhere along the line, a gunman may appear and act in a similar fashion, recklessly and carelessly, and kill another innocent human being. For what? For what? What's the purpose of that? All it does is destroy families and destroy lives. There's no justification for any of it.
Nicola, thank you very much for talking to us this morning. You're good to give us your time, and very brave to talk to us, because it obviously, listening to you, listening to what you're not saying, it doesn't sound like it's getting easier.
No, it's not. It's not. And Lyra and I were extremely, extremely close, and I'm much older than her, and we remained close throughout her whole life, and it's very difficult to live without her.
Well, stay safe and take care of yourself, and thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Take care.
Listening to Nicola there now is Jonathan Powell, former Chief of Staff for Tony Blair, and Alex Kane, the political columnist and commentator in Northern Ireland. Jonathan Powell, it's hard to believe that once again we're back at a place where parents are telling their kids to leave Northern Ireland.
Yes, it was very moving to hear Nicola's comments, having gone through what she's gone through. It's really sad to see this back on the streets. And I think it does, as she said, require political leadership. It needs someone to take a grip of this. And for the Prime Minister, the British Prime Minister, to take a week to even get round to tweeting on the subject strikes me as irresponsible. I'm glad to see that the Taoiseach has been more forward, and now they've spoken together and they're going to take a more of a driving seat on this. Because I think with political leadership, with the involvement of the two governments and the involvement of the party leaders in Northern Ireland, this can be brought under control. This is not going to be a return to the troubles, but this is it could be a very hot summer if we don't get this under control now. And the trouble is the political elements bubbling underneath. So this started off with, it looks like, with criminal elements getting kids out onto the street to avoid police dealing with them. But now it's turned into something bigger, and the tinder underneath, this is very serious. And to have politicians in Northern Ireland actually playing with matches, as Nicola said, is really discouraging. You'd have thought they'd be more responsible.
I watched Theresa Villiers, the former Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, on Newsnight last night, and Kirsty Wark said to her, look, you've got to own this. You promised that this wasn't going to happen before the Brexit referendum. And her response was to say, rioting and lawlessness has disfigured Northern Ireland over decades. Brexit is not an excuse. Would it be fair enough to say that if Brexiteers aren't going to own their own mistakes here, are they likely to feel any obligation to fix them?
It is true there are no excuses for the kind of rioting we've seen of any sort. But it's also true that it's clear that what Boris Johnson did on Brexit by opting to put a border in the Irish Sea, I mean, as Tony Blair and John Major pointed out in Belfast and in Derry before the referendum, or during the referendum on Brexit, that someone was going to get hurt by Brexit. Either there's going to be a border on the island of Ireland, or there's going to be a border in the Irish Sea. Boris Johnson, in the end, to get his deal, opted for a border in the Irish Sea and then lied about it, told the people of Northern Ireland there wouldn't be a border, there would be no forms. And so when they've discovered that that's absolutely completely untrue, of course, they're very angry about it. And that, combined with various other factors, has led to this volatile atmosphere. And I think it is incumbent on the British government to now get on and be pragmatic and come to a deal with the EU and making the protocol work as best as possible, light touch as possible. There is no alternative. Those like Arlene Foster calling for an end to the protocol have to tell us what it's going to be replaced with. They have no answer. There is no alternative. We tried for 6 years to find alternatives and there aren't any. So we've got to make this work. The British government has to sit down calmly rather than posturing with the EU and actually come up with a workable solution that helps the people of Northern Ireland.
Look, obviously the Good Friday Agreement is the singular achievement of your generation of politicians and civil servants. But do we, I wonder, have to acknowledge that part of the reason for what is going on is that the Good Friday Agreement hasn't worked for these communities, that there never was a peace dividend on Lanark Way, there was only a peace wall?
I think the Good Friday Agreement actually has served us very well over the last 20-odd years, and I would be very loath to see people trying to unpick it or undermine it, and I think we should not go down that route. That said, I do believe the loyalist community in particular has been left behind, both socially and economically and politically. Ever since Davy Irvine died, they've lacked a really strong political voice, and the other political parties don't really represent those in these most deprived areas. And they've been subject to the sort of criminality that's been, you know, pretty debilitating for them. You have amongst the lowest educational attainment in Europe in some of these areas in Belfast, loyalist areas. It's the reason that a few years ago I participated in the launch of the loyalist, the LCC, and I hoped that
loyalist
that would
community
reach
council.
Out. Loyalist community council, sorry, yes, that would reach out politically, because some of them, it's wrong to turn our backs on these people. There are serious problems of criminality the police have to deal with. With serious problems with this rioting, the police have to deal with. But there's also some of them who would like to find a political way out for their communities. And I think actually Dublin, successive presidents in Ireland have done their best to reach out to these communities, and we should continue to do so. It's very tempting to turn your backs on these people, but we should not do so.
So this is interesting. Is it your opinion then that when we hear people from Lanark Way and from the Shankill Road saying that this community has not been well served by the Good Friday Agreement, that would resonate with you?
No, I think they're quite wrong to blame the Good Friday Agreement for not providing for them. It is
their politicians' fault, then.
It's their politicians who've not provided the leadership or the kind of programs that are necessary for these very, very deprived areas. I think that's they blame it on the Good Friday Agreement, by which they mean the sort of establishment rather than the agreement itself. The agreement found a way the two communities could live alongside each other without identity being the dominating issue, so they could concentrate on things like education and health and issues of normal politics rather than just about identity. The trouble with this is it's brought the whole issue of identity back up again because of Brexit.
Alex Kane, good morning to you. As a former Ulster Unionist Party communications director and also obviously a keen student of history, can you point to any point at which stoking these kind of fears has ever worked in the past for unionism?
Morning, Philip. No, I can't. It doesn't. If you, in my lifetime, and I go back to 1972 when Stormont was prorogued, I was in the grounds of Stormont, 100,000 people there, you know, completely lost. They had no idea this was coming. There's this massive feeling of being let down by their own government, that the government had rolled over to the IRA, which is exactly the same language you're hearing 50 years on. The Good Friday Agreement, 150,000 people in the centre of Belfast, Drumcree, tens of thousands of people. I could give you a whole list of occasions, Philip, when unionism was riled up and told that it had to take to the street, or it had to protest, or it had to get the bands out, or it had to do something to show its anger. But set against that, and I think Jonathan touched upon it, you know, in the protocol thing, there has never been a time when unionism has ever seemed to gather behind a viable, available alternative. 1974, when they brought down Sunningdale. Huge, you know, they brought 100,000 people for that as well. They brought down Brian Faulkner's power sharing executive. They managed to get the assembly collapsed. And then afterwards, they hadn't a clue what to do. Unionism fell apart again. And they had to wait for another 24 years until they get another executive. And now we're back on exactly the same territory. And this is the tragedy, the drama, the stupidity, the futility sometimes of unionism, that while it is very good, brilliant, if you like, at the rhetoric of anger, it is absolutely useless at what's the nuance of negotiation, of looking at what's available and trying to capitalise on it. We're just not good at that.
Your read of history there is so clear-headed and so obvious. I wonder why there aren't more people in unionism that don't share your analysis.
Well, do you know that I think there's an increase. I don't mean my particular analysis, but I think there's an increasing number of people within unionism who have finally realised that the old ways don't work. Brian Faulkner, when he was coming down from on his last day as chief executive in 1974, passing Carson's statue, he said the problem is now with all these people have been let down by would-be Carsons, and I think that's the problem. And there are still people who think there are alternatives, but what we've seen is a form of, you know, I don't like to call it middle-class unionism, but more liberal, secular unionism, a huge growth of in that unionist demographic. Those people have now switched to the Alliance Party. And whether the Alliance Party, oddly enough, is agnostic on the constitutional question. It says if there's a border poll, people will make up their own minds, they'll weigh up the arguments. That's extraordinary, that people who 5, 6, 7 years ago were voting Ulster Unionist, were voting Democratic Unionist Party, quite clear, you know, constitutional parties for the union, are now so fed up with that manifestation of unionism, Philip, that they are willing to vote for a party which is quite openly agnostic on the constitution. That's extraordinary, and it's extraordinary that Arlene Foster in particular, and key members of the DUP, and key members of the Loyalist Communities Council, and I was there the day it was launched when Jonathan was in the room, and I had sympathy for it because I thought loyalism didn't need to be listened to. We're still at this stage, 6 years from that launch, where loyalism and the DUP still have not cottoned on. That you can't just say no, 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 because people will say, well, what are you giving us instead? That's how politics really works.
Do you share Jonathan's analysis that one community has been served much better than the other, if not by the Good Friday Agreement, certainly by its politicians?
Well, I think that's key to this. I think that's a very important point Jonathan did make, and I think that was the whole point behind the thinking of the Loyalist Communities Council. It was to bring that coalition. That's worth saying to your audience, Philip, because we talk about loyalism as if it's just one sort of demographic. It's not. Loyalism is a very mixed bag, like unionism itself. There are all sorts of facets and manifestations of it. So trying to get it together in a coherent movement is very difficult. But yes, it is true that in terms of if loyalists do feel left behind, and I live in East Belfast, so I'm close to some of these areas, they've been left behind in schooling, they've been left behind in housing, they've been left behind in employment, in economic opportunity. You go into parts of West Belfast, parts of North Belfast, which have a large, strong Sinn Féin nationalist presence, you can actually see the visible changes on the ground since 1998, the new buildings, the new opportunities, the new jobs and so on. Come to parts of East Belfast and South Belfast, which are, you know, in loyalist unionist hands, and you don't see that. And that what they've been told over and over again for not simply the past 20 years, Philip, they've been told for most of their lives, the South is the enemy. Anyone, basically anyone who isn't a unionist is the enemy. And instead of focusing on progress and looking at where improvement can be made, which is what nationalism does. Nationalism will take anything, anything, and say, even if it's only five jobs, they'll say, Five jobs is an improvement. Unionism, why don't we have five jobs? Why don't we do this? And that's the problem. Unionists, loyalists in particular, have been almost conditioned, almost Pavlovian, to assume that their lack of jobs, their lack of economic opportunity, is somehow the fault of Sinn Féin and the SDLP for doing the job of politics properly.
Thank you very much, Alex Kane and Jonathan Powell as well. Coming up after the break, Minister Eamon Ryan.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.